Bookend your day with Essential Listening. Breakfast and drive from 6am and PM on RN.
And yes, welcome to Life Matters for the next hour of your morning. Right here on RN, Natasha Mitchell joining you, pleased to be with you. What can other or altered states of consciousness tell us about the creative mind? And I'm not talking about taking psychedelics here. Sometimes the brain can create its own firework display without any help. Jim Chambliss was a successful attorney, and then something big happened to his brain. What followed was a really powerful feeling that he needed to make art and research other artists who had experienced the same. He joins us today, as does our everyday economics correspondent Peter Martin. Time to take a close look at that hex debt. It is not a case of out of mind, out of sight. That's coming up. You can tweet us at RN Life Matters. As we know, the world's biggest gathering of expertise on HIV and AIDS is happening in Melbourne right now. Many of the city's buildings, I gather, are lit up in red each night to honour the thousands who have gathered for this really important conference. Some believe 2014 could be something of a tipping point year, with technology and new treatments moving us somewhat closer to slowing the epidemic that kills so many people, that leaves children orphaned, that leaves families fractured and communities grieving. And yet many HIV workers are operating in rather dangerous and divisive conditions, which forces them to work secretly or negotiate their way through a maze of religious and cultural prejudices and practices. Despite the obstacles, though, there are many reasons to be positive. We're going to meet three Red Cross staff this morning to talk about their work. From St James in Jamaica, we have Romaine Knight, who is a Red Cross HIV outreach worker. Welcome, Romaine.
Welcome. Thank you so much.
Great to have you.
I'm happy to be here.
Yes, great to have you. And from Uganda, we have Prosper Bionanebye, a senior manager for HIV and AIDS with the Ugandan Red Cross Society. Welcome, Prosper.
Oh, great to be here.
Great to have you. And at the helm, we have Dr. Tonya Nagiro, who is head of the HIV and TB unit for the International Federation of Red Cross Red Crescent. Previously, I gather, director of the Department of Gender, Women and Health at the WHO. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Really pleased to be here this morning.
Tonya, what particularly triggered your own work and leadership now in the HIV AIDS arena? Is this personal to you?
It is. It's absolutely personal. I'm originally from Tanzania, actually from Zanzibar, and so I come from a family and a community that is both infected and affected by HIV. So I've kind of lived and lived it and seen it both in my community and in my family on a personal level. And then professionally, had always worked in international health and development across Africa, Caribbean, and Asia, and really became passionate about the fight against HIV/AIDS and really dealing with some of the key areas of women in HIV in particular and trying to address gender inequality and stigma and discrimination. So
yes.
Both personal and professional.
I'll come to African women in just a moment, so key. And I won't get too personal, but how would you describe the impact that HIV/AIDS has had in your own family?
Well, I think it's a combination of devastation and resilience. I mean, I think loss in one's family, loss of family members that are taken away too soon is always devastating and really tragic. But on the other hand, I think what HIV has done despite the tragedy, and this goes beyond my family, is really it brings oftentimes, or can in some instances, bring communities together and families together to, you know, reformulate and to fight and to rebond in different ways. And so, you know, I think there is a silver lining. Despite the devastation, there is a silver lining in the sense that it provides an opportunity to come together in new and different ways.
Yes, that said, though, it can divide communities and families too, can't it?
Absolutely. And that's where I think some of the issues of stigma and discrimination come in, without question.
Tonya, I remember a very moving and a very angry speech that Stephen Lewis gave some years ago at Harvard. He was the UN Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Africa. And at that time, he described the AIDS pandemic in Africa as exacting a carnage amongst women that knows no parallel in modern history. Is that how you see it?
Yeah, in the African context, absolutely. I mean, I think, as you know, more than half of the victims of HIV in Africa are women. And the reason being for that, it plays out, or the reason women are particularly vulnerable plays out because of the gender dynamics, the power dynamics, the economics. And HIV is it's a discriminatory disease in the sense that it plays off of poverty, it plays off of inequality, it plays off of those who don't have power. And in the African context, it's women who don't have the power, and so the means or the lack of means that they have, either to education, the lack of ability to negotiate safe sex, the lack of ability to protect themselves as people, but also their children, their daughters, and so forth. So it is without question in the African context a women-based disease. Having said that, though, and I think. Above and beyond that, though, and I think, we look at some of the high epidemic countries, there are still pockets of other vulnerable populations that I think in the African context that we overlook. And that is really MSM, men who have sex with men. And in some countries, even Zanzibar, my own country, it's injecting drug users that are also incredibly vulnerable. So while, I'm very passionate and it's important not to forget women, it's also really critical to not leave behind or to overlook the other populations that, in an African context, are also heavily stigmatized and discriminated against.
Just before I come to Prosper and Romain, nevertheless, you do believe, Tonya, that we have reached a tipping point for HIV/AIDS. That's a very strong statement to make, and a risky one. Why do you think that?
Well, I think first I'm an eternal optimist, and I think tipping point could go one way or another, right? I mean, we could go forward or we could go backwards, and so I think I choose to hope and believe that we're tipping in the right direction, that the end of AIDS is in sight. And I think we have the tools at our hand. I mean, we have and we've been listening all week in the sessions, both to the evidence, to the science, to the technologies that we have. I mean, we have the tools at our disposal.
But we might have the tools, but when something like one in three people living with HIV is still unaware of their status, what use are the tools?
Well, the tools, I mean, I think the tools are critical because at least now we know. I mean, it took us many years into the epidemic to really fully understand what worked and what didn't. And for example, the fact that ARVs are much more accessible.
Antiretroviral drugs,
exactly. And us as the Red Cross, I think there's been a tipping point from the standpoint of moving testing and treatment out of the clinics and into the communities. And so we really put forth a community-based service delivery model, and I think by working through Red Cross volunteers, through trained community health workers, we can actually break open the human resource constraints that we have around testing, treatment, adherence support, prevention, and we really feel that this is a very exciting time in the HIV epidemic, and like I said, I would argue that we're tipping and moving forward in the right direction.
Okay, I mean, speaking of antiretroviral drugs, one of the biggest problems is poor access. Prosper Bionyabe, sorry about that. For you, though, in Uganda, I gather there is stigma about drugs themselves. In what way?
Yeah, stigma in a way that you find, for instance, a woman accessing treatment alone is not enough because, for instance, the husband, for instance, didn't escort her for testing. Mm. And if she tested her own and, for instance, she's found to be she needs to be put on treatment, she can't go on treatment while the husband is not aware. So here she is, she has tested, she has done all the tests and it shows that she needs to go on treatment, but she can't be on treatment because she's stigmatized in the sense that if the husband got to know, then it's a problem.
So she's stigmatized within her own relationship.
Exactly.
Mm. I mean, that's tough, isn't it? Why do you think that message that these drugs will keep you alive doesn't cut through?
It's partly because these drugs are not yet accessible deep in the rural areas, in the remote communities. Secondly, that the issue of male involvement, the issue of power dynamics that we had already talked about, the economic part of it, women having to depend on men, you know. So it's somehow a bit tricky, but we are trying to move forward to make sure that the message is clear to the men, the message is clear to the women, so that this issue of stigma about treatment is eradicated.
So how do you do that? Because, I mean, certainly HIV/AIDS touches the entire population in Uganda in one way or another. Over 7% of adults are HIV positive, I gather. How do you cut through that stigma as someone working there on the ground?
Yeah, thanks to the big team of volunteers spread across the country, and we are talking about young men and women who are outside there in the community, ready to do what we call home visits, community visits, take the message. We have what we call treatment preparedness, where you talk to the community, you go and test. We have outreach sessions whereby we go and test people in the communities. If they are found to be HIV positive, we tell them it's no longer about witchcraft, it's no longer about cultural issues, which people used to hide behind, but now we are saying this is real, this is HIV, and it needs antiretroviral treatment for you to be well.
Mm. Yep. We know that homosexuality, or men sleeping with other men in Uganda, is illegal. How significant has this been an issue for the HIV epidemic in Uganda?
Yeah, it's been an issue. As you're aware, there was the anti-homosexual bill was passed last year.
Yeah.
It's been an issue in as far as accessing the people are concerned, but I can say the enforcement has not yet been too bad to us, the implementers, though you can't openly just go on radio and say, I want to meet men having sex with men tomorrow in this place and this place. So, of course, it affects the mobilization part of it. But generally, I can say we still go undercover, see these people, try to give them the message. We are currently trying to look at the new mods, like, for instance, using Facebook, using WhatsApp, and these other new
using social media. Yeah, but it's difficult, isn't it? Because if men are having sex with men and they're married, as is the case in many situations, they're not going to out themselves to get tested, are they?
Wow, yeah, that's another tricky part. Yeah, it's a challenging one, Getting them tested is also another challenge, yeah.
Big challenge. Romaine King, in Jamaica where you work, is there stigma around how HIV is contracted? Is that also an issue for you?
Stigma around how HIV is contracted?
Mm.
Well, it depends. If it's about the MSM community, then there is some level of stigma around that, because men who have sex with men engage in anal sex. And so if someone is a part of that community and contracts HIV, then the stigma that is placed on anal sex is indirectly placed on that individual himself.
It's not just placed on that sexual act, though, is it? It's actually, the stigma then is translated across to condoms, lubricants, so fundamental in curbing the spread of HIV.
Yeah, it's placed on lubricants more so because in Jamaica, lubricant use or lubricant purchasing is linked to anal sex. And because Jamaica is homophobic, and because of the laws and because of the religious beliefs and the culture that exists in Jamaica, it makes it very difficult for individuals to pick up, from men who have sex with men, to go ahead and purchase lubricants, because they will be stigmatized or discriminated against, because they're thought, what are they going to be doing with the lubricants? They're going to be engaging in anal sex. And it's heavily stigmatized. And so it makes it very difficult for these individuals, for men who have sex with men, to access these life-saving tools to engage in sex.
I mean, people might have the perception that Jamaica is an incredibly open society. There's something about that incredible Caribbean music culture. Mm-hmm. But in fact, I gather you make the case that there are aspects of that music culture mm-hmm. that also propagate stigma. How?
Well, some of the music in dance hall, you know, speaks to being against homosexuality. You have music that basically says that it's okay to inflict violence upon someone who is a homosexual. And there's a lot of cases, there's a lot of music that speaks to that. Over the time, over a period of time, we have tried to. There are organizations that have worked with some of the dance hall artists to get them to pull back on the messages that they're sending. And some of the dancehall artists are accepting that message, but for the most part, some of them are, you know, that's a part of what sells their music because of the culture. People want that kind of music because that's the underlying belief that homosexuality is wrong in Jamaica. Mm. So that music ultimately makes you money.
So how do you work on the ground? Because, well, first of all, what can happen if a man is caught having sex with a man?
You'd be at that point in time, you'd be infringing upon the line 76 of the Offences Against the Persons Act, and according to that particular law, you could be placed in prison for a maximum of 10 years if you're found to be engaging in anal sex.
Makes it mm-hmm. very hard for you to do your work, and you do a lot of it underground. So what does that look like?
Well, what it looks like, we have a peer education project, a peer education program. We recruit individuals who are part of the MSM community, the men who have sex with men community. And, you know, we include individuals who are from different subgroups of the community. So we have the down low men who are part of the program who have girlfriends on the side or who have wives on the side. We have individuals who are from the church who are peer educators. We have, you know, the very effeminate individuals who are part of it. It's very open and inclusive, but we have individuals from different cross sections of the community. And that helps our reach. Because someone who is married and in a relationship in Jamaica would feel better interacting with someone who understands their situation. And so you'd have the peer who is also down low interacting with that individual and sharing with them, you know, what is HIV, how is HIV contracted. They give them tools for engaging in sex, lubricants, water-based lubricants. You get your condoms, flavored condoms, everything from that peer. So we try to, that's how a part of our project looks. Another part, we utilize social media. Social media is very good in Jamaica because what you find is that individuals, they create other profiles on Facebook, you know, gay profiles, and they will access the groups that we have going in Jamaica. And in our groups, we have bishops, we have pastors, we have preachers, we have doctors, we have lawyers inside that group speaking about issues affecting them. So we talk a lot about safer sex and things like that. So we have the peer education, and we also utilize social media. We do other things as well, but I'm sure I take up all of your program.
Oh, no, not a bit, but it sounds fantastic, what you're managing to achieve, given the stigma. Prosper, in Uganda, I gather you're starting right back in primary education, which surprises me. I mean, HIV education is happening at the primary school level. Sex education is happening at the primary school level.
Yeah, true.
Tell us what you're doing.
We have what we call basic health promotion education right from the primary level. And that's where HIV comes in. So you have a package talking about growth and development. You're talking about body parts of a human being, and you're trying to give this message to the young people. And as you try to explain, then HIV comes in because you're talking about maybe some of the infections that a human being is likely to get. And you generally talk about sexually transmitted infections. So you don't really pronounce HIV, but you just talk about all of them, syphilis, gonorrhea, HIV now comes up, but you don't really emphasize it. To the extent that even when you talk about prevention, condom comes in not as an isolated preventive device for HIV, but for sexually transmitted infections. So in a way, these young kids get to know about HIV, but as an infection which is among the many infections that can affect a
human. It's in context, but it's early on, and that's key. Tonya Nigiri, just briefly, finally to you, I gather there's been quite a lot of success in Zambia, particularly in terms of your focus on how women are involved, how women are impacted in terms of the spread of HIV in Africa and elsewhere. What has turned around in Zambia?
Yeah, I mean, I think Zambia is an interesting example because it's a country where, first of all, there's been a huge amount of political commitment. So the national government has been on board, the National AIDS Committee. I mean, the president talks about HIV/AIDS, and so at the national level and within government, there's an open dialogue around HIV/AIDS and a very strong commitment. That's helped bring in donors. It's helped bring in implementing partners, and one of the key factors of success, and I think one of the elements that really breaks open stigma and discrimination is working through faith-based organizations and through local organizations such as the Zambian National Society. I mean, we work through our branch and our local community offices, and there it's really we've been very successful engaging faith leaders and
really
again whether it's imams and ministers and preachers.
Are they having frank conversations about sex?
Well, you know, again, I think there's degrees of ability to be able to speak about condoms. I mean, I think there are some cases, yes, where you do have preachers and ministers that are, you know, they want, I mean, at the end of the day, they want to see their parishes, their congregations healthy. And in the case where, a high epidemic country like Zambia, where people really are dying and you see, you know, the devastating communities, I do think the religious leaders have taken a much more active role, and what we've been able to do is really educate the religious leaders and bring them on board and have them own, in their own words, really HIV prevention and so forth. I mean, I think there still are many communities that are preaching abstinence as one prevention aspect, but there are others that are speaking and have maybe more progressive beliefs and attitudes and feel that, you know, life-saving drugs and access to other prevention methodologies are really critical. So at least, I mean, I think most religious leaders don't have a problem with, you know, promoting access to testing and treatment and so forth.
If only we could bottle what you're achieving in Zambia. Look, thank you. Barely a glance at what you're all doing, but fantastic to get that snapshot from Jamaica, from Uganda, and really across the whole region. Good luck with your attendance at the International AIDS Conference this week. Romain Knight, Dr. Tonya Nigiro, and Prosper Bionanebe, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Pleasure.
And of course, that conference continues. Thousands of delegates in Melbourne. Fantastic to talk to three of the guests. Natasha Mitchell with you here on Life Matters, right here on RN. Now, open up that hex debt. We're looking more closely at it just a tick with Peter Martin.
What can and what can't you say in a democracy? All societies impose restrictions on what can be said through the courts or civil bodies, but do these limits curb our democratic rights?
We benefit, all of us, from the ability to say what we think. And there is always somebody, somewhere, who thinks it would be better if we didn't.
The Times writer David Aronovich defends freedom of speech on Big Ideas tomorrow night at 8 here on RN.
So let's head to university now. Imagine this, two students, both going to university at the same time, both charged the same fee, both graduating together. One has a more manageable debt, perhaps $50,000 to $60,000, doesn't sound so manageable, but the other ends up paying $100,000. New calculations about the effect of the government's higher education changes suggest it's possible. And what might concern you more is that the student who ends up paying the most will be those on the lowest income. Peter Martin has looked at these calculations. He joins us for Everyday Economics this week. He is the economics editor for The Age. Welcome back.
G'day, Natasha.
Peter, can you quickly recap on what the government is proposing in terms of changes to university fees? Because the latest federal budget did shift things quite significantly.
Yeah. Now, it should be pointed out this isn't through the Senate, okay? So Clive Palmer is standing in the way for the moment. But from 2016, not next year, the year after, get in early if you want to study. abandoned that gap year. From then, universities will be able to charge what they like up to the ceiling of whatever they're charging foreign students. Now, usually this will mean that fees double. So what costs $25,000 now might cost $50,000 or $60,000.
What do you mean usually it means that fees double? Do we know that?
That's our experience in the United Kingdom when fees were deregulated. Think about a fruit market. You're buying an apple, right? Now, if the seller, tries to put the price up, tries to double the price of an apple, you probably won't buy it. That's a restraint on them, right? It's not like that for higher education, partly because there's only one supplier. You can't go anywhere else. I mean, you've got to go to a registered university, and if you want to go to one of the G8, the more elite universities, you've got really very little choice. But also, if the person who was selling the apple didn't charge you for them at the time, but it was only going to be on the Never Never when your income climbed, you probably want to buy the apple, given that you didn't have to pay at the time for the price being asked. That's why people think that if you allow universities to charge what they want, up to a much higher ceiling than what they're charging now, a typical degree now might cost $30,000, $25,000, they'll probably double it. Now, we don't know, but that's what's likely.
Now, what else has changed is the way the interest is calculated on the loan or the debt, and that is the point of this whole discussion, isn't it?
Yes, and this wasn't talked about, this wasn't looked at on budget night, I suppose, because the prospect of fees doubling is probably frightening by itself.
Mm.
It seems like a minor change, and you'd only think it was a minor change if, like most people, you didn't understand the power of compound interest. You've heard the mythical quote attributed to Albert Einstein about the power of compound interest.
No, I think I've forgotten that.
Oh, I thought you would know. He was apparently asked, although the story came out well after his death, so it's probably not true, what was the most powerful force in the universe? People expected he might say gravity or something like that. He said compound interest. how it works, what the measure is to essentially double the interest rate. Doesn't sound like much. The interest rate is at the moment the inflation rate. So if you like, there's a zero real interest rate. So it's 2.5%. Unless your circumstances change dramatically for the worse, no matter how long you delay paying the loan, it's not going to increase in terms of its burden on you. And that's going to increase to the government bond rate, which over time is typically 5%. There's an upper limit on 6%. That's quite a lot different from 2.5%. Now, if you want to know how compound interest works, this power of compound interest, think about someone who takes out a home loan. This is at the current home loan interest rate of 5.5%. Someone who takes out a home loan and then doesn't make any payments for 10 years.
Mm.
And you can see the analogy, because lots of people who leave university don't get into incomes high enough to have to pay for many years. People take time off to have babies and so on. In the case of a home loan, if you didn't make payments for 10 years, your loan would jump 70%. That's how big it is. If the interest rate was 6%, it would jump 80%. This is a very large impost which will fall most probably, well, certainly it'll fall on anyone unwise enough to take gap years or time out of the workforce or go overseas for some years after university. If you don't make payments straight away, you're
in trouble. And so, this is the key, that if you're on a lower income and it takes longer for you to get to that threshold level at which you have to start paying, I think it's around $51,000, isn't it? Then that impact of compound interest is going to be much more profound. So you're going to end up with a bigger hex debt.
Yes. If you graduated, if you became a nurse, say, and you worked part-time, you would not have to repay for 10 years. Now, that's the case now. No? You would not have to repay until your income climbed above the threshold. Now, no problem there at the moment, but you will find yourself with a far bigger debt. Now, these people are definitionally low-income earners. This is why they won't have to repay. Also, low-income people are disadvantaged in another way, which can be crudely put by just referring to daddy. If someone graduates, two people together, one has a daddy who will pay off a big chunk of the hex debt. They'll be sweet. Their $60,000 isn't going to increase to $100,000. But someone else who is unable to do that, and especially if they're unable to work in the early years, will find they have a very big income.
The argument, though, is that your earning capacity is improved by going to university, and so that you should be able to service a loan on that basis.
Yes.
And I guess that doesn't, you know, compound interest is still going to impact you if you delay your payments.
Yes, but the argument that people who've been to university have higher wages while it's because of going to university, while there's some truth in it, it's overstated. The government in the budget papers said that going to university earns you an extra million over your lifetime. Here's why it's wrong. It's partly right, but here's what's wrong about it. One thing is that many people pay university fees and don't graduate. Okay, so there's a sort of misspecification in talking about graduates. The other is there's really no measure of what happens with comparing like for like. So people who get into university are different year 12 graduates than people who don't. It's highly likely that they would go on to earn higher incomes over their life. I mean, we already know they've probably got higher marks in year 12. Higher incomes over their life without going to university. The government pushed this figure on budget night to make it look as if, university was a ticket to wealth. It is for some people, I guess, but it's not for some. If you're a teacher and you decide you want to stay a classroom teacher, you don't want, my dad was one of these people, you don't want promotion to be a senior master. This is not what you want to do, okay? Mm. Your income is going to be, shall we say, modest for the rest of your life. Yes, you will have got a university degree. So it doesn't necessarily follow. Now, in the case of someone who's a teacher, your income will be above $51,000, so you will have to make repayments. But the repayments you have to make, repayments are a proportion of income, 2% of income, will be small. And because you're making small payments, you have much the same effect in that you'll end up with a far, far, far bigger debt than someone who, gets a $100,000 job.
Whether or not our estates will be left paying the rest of our hex debt, it's actually very pertinent here, isn't it?
Well, if the government, and that's the next logical step, by the way, I don't think that this government would have the courage to do that, but that's right. What's perhaps more likely is that parents will pay it off. I mentioned daddy. The other interesting prospect is that I think there's all sorts of unintended consequences here. I actually don't think they've thought through what will happen.
But the government didn't set out to try and penalise university graduates who happen to become low income
earners. I don't think it set out to penalise poor people. I don't think it thought about them. What about parents who at the moment put themselves through awful hardship in order to give their child a place at a private school, okay? That's an awful lot of money over those years of high school. It will make more sense when people come to realise the power of compound interest, which will now become relevant. It'll make more sense for them not to send those children to private schools, to save the money.
And pay off their hex debts.
Yeah, use it to whack it down.
Mm.
We will see if this comes to pass, and it may come to pass, it may be changed, but if it does come to pass, the very serious financial advice, which I suppose is the advice, that financial planners always give you, is make big inroads into the debt straight away. Don't wait. Don't take time off work. Postpone having children if you need to, and get it down.
It's pretty tricky if you're trying to pay hefty city rents as well. Good luck, I say. So if I had to get you to sum up compound interest in a sentence or two, what would you say?
I would say that it's frightening. There's one figure that financial planners
use. I want a proper definition, Peter.
Well, compound interest, okay.
So interest on interest.
But you would think that if something increased 5% a year, after 10 years, it would have increased 50%. Wrong. It will have increased 70%. Because it's 5% on 5% of the new higher figure, of the new higher figure, of the new higher figure. And it snowballs.
Say that in one sentence.
I won't. I'll just give you this figure. I'll just give you this horrible stat. This horrible stat.
This is a very serious issue. I mean, this really is a very serious issue.
Well, it is said that it is so serious that you would save better for your retirement by saving when you're 20, if you start working, save for 10 years and then stop. You would have more money in retirement thanks to the compound interest saving between the year, 20 years old and 30 years old, more money than if you'd waited till you were 40 and saved for 40 years. So the compound interest, saving early and then letting that 5%, 2% adding to what's been added on year after year makes an enormous difference. And it does with paying off loans too.
A mortgage, that's right. Get in, pay as much early
or
on.
Or a university degree.
Yeah. Yes. Well, look, this has big consequences for a lot of people. Can I just briefly ask, does this have consequences for those who have already started uni or went to uni some years ago, have a HECS debt that was in place before these changes?
Believe it or not, yes. Now, Tony Abbott got this wrong in a radio interview. He said that old university students, people such as yourself, you may still have a HECS debt. I don't know. If you do, your HECS debt will now be subject to these new higher interest rates. Now, you've probably had a few years to pay it down. But someone who already has a HECS debt, went to university 10 years ago, will find themselves caught up in these higher interest rates. Mm. So from January 1, 2016, if the legislation's passed, it's going to be much more difficult, I suppose, to live your life, much more difficult to decide to have a baby, decide to do a course for fun, even if there's no income attached to it at the end.
Very interesting, very important discussion, Peter Martin. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Pleasure.
Yeah, this is... I mean, even with a small HECS debt, I noticed that indexation was massive, which really put the wind on me, I have to say, in relation to paying off a HECS debt. Natasha Mitchell with you this morning. Love your thoughts on this. Can you get in touch with us in all the usual ways? You can get in touch with us via our website, abc.net.au/rn. Look for Life Matters. You can email us from there. You can comment on the story. You can get on our Facebook page and our listener feedback line, 02833 1430. An attorney turned artist with a very particular tale to tell is joining us next.
One of the world's most famous reference books is Grey's Anatomy. There's even a TV show named after it. The creation of the book was itself something of a medical drama. First, Grey tried to kill off the illustrator.
The first edition proofs, with Grey's corrections all over them, he basically cut through Carter's name on the title page.
Crossed it out.
Yes.
Then he was accused of plagiarism. The story of Grey's Anatomy in the body sphere. Sunday afternoon at 5 on RN.
Yeah, I'm loving The Body Sphere with Amanda Smith. So terrific. Loving her promos, actually, as much as the show. Look, speaking of creativity, is the epileptic brain uniquely creative, uniquely artistic, perhaps? My next guest's personal experience and research might suggest so. Might art even have a diagnostic role here? Epilepsy really has long been misunderstood and often maligned as a neurological condition. Thankfully, we have moved on from the time when people with epileptic seizures were thought to be under the spell of demonic possession. A former attorney, life took a radical turn for Dr. Jim Chambliss, now an award-winning artist. He'd never made art before he developed epilepsy, and now his unique PhD research has given birth to an exhibition, Epilepsy, Perception, Imagination and Change, on at the University of Melbourne's Cultural Treasures Festival this weekend. And he joins us this morning on Life Matters. Welcome, Jim.
Hello.
Tell me, what especially inspired your own exploration into this juncture between art and medicine, which is what you've delved into in your PhD?
My inspiration was my personal experience of discovering a creative talent and a more visual and creative mindset. After I discovered that, I became quite curious as to why that occurred and started looking at some of the patterns that were shared by other people thought to have had epilepsy in the past and people living with epilepsy.
This is a long way from your life as a lawyer, isn't it? You didn't always have epilepsy. Perhaps you can tell us what happened.
I acquired epilepsy as a result of a brain injury. After the brain injury, I was having complex partial seizures, which I didn't recognize what they were. I'm also photosensitive, meaning that certain light patterns can trigger a seizure, not so much now that I'm on medication. But I was at a Christmas party one night. I had an olfactory hallucination, which was a gross, burning, rubbish type of a smell. So I excused myself from the person I was talking to, stood up, and the next thing I remember was someone saying, "Do you know your name? Do you know where you are? And do you know what happened?" So I had a seizure, fell on my face, and had partial amnesia, difficulty remembering names and the laws I had learned in school. So that changed my life quite significantly.
How significantly?
Well, I saw over the year, two, 3 years of recovery that my law practice just eroded.
Because really your brain had changed fundamentally, hadn't it, at that time?
It had. I had had trouble remembering things, processing what I read, what I heard for a while. My math skills and spelling skills dropped.
But I think this actually, in you, ignited this sense that you needed to make art. Tell us about that very strong feeling, that impulse.
Well, there are a couple of impulses that can come with the behavioral changes of epilepsy. There's what's called hypergraphia, and that's a compulsive tendency to write or make art in great detail. And also with epilepsy, there are what I call intrinsic perceptions, which are visual illusions, pseudo-hallucinations, and experiences that are triggered by epilepsy that are quite unique and rare. And it's the novelty that is what makes art more creative.
And I'll come to those intrinsic perceptions because they've been fundamental in your conversations with over 100 artists with epilepsy. This has formed the basis of your PhD work and this exhibition that Melburnians can see. What were you exploring in your early art? What did you make? What did you create?
Part of my art was about my own experiences. I was quite curious as to what happened to my brain. I also needed to cope a bit with the changes in my life, so some of my work became about that.
Tell us about some of that artwork, though. How did you represent this experience?
I have a sculpture called Discovering the Source, which is a ceramic sculpture you may have seen in the advertisement for the exhibition.
Is this the wonderful brain on a kind of a rock?
That's correct. It's made entirely of ceramics, including the tools that are with it, made to look like the hammer and carving tool. And the brain itself is enlarged. It's encased in a stone, which is a metaphor for how difficult it is to understand the brain and to find a way to heal the neurological impairment.
What did making art help you make sense of?
It helped me make sense of my new creative awakening. It also helped in a cathartic way.
Because life had changed so fundamentally, and this has prompted really what became a whole unique research effort, unique in the world, I think, to interview artists who have epilepsy about their work. Were there themes that came up again and again for you in those conversations?
The themes that came up were where people had experienced things that were rather dreamlike and highly imaginative and surreal, It may be something that came entirely from within one's mind and brain, which was incredibly unique. It may also be how the brain altered what a person perceived and what they saw or what they felt.
Mm. So what research problem did you set yourself? What were the questions that you were interested in probing?
We started out probing how you could use art as a diagnostic and interpretive tool. That was of interest to me because when I had the first seizure and ended up in the hospital, the neurologist did not pick up on the fact that I had epilepsy. He noticed some sharp transient spikes, or one of them, but disregarded that. A few months later, I had an automobile accident and ran off the road. So I lived through that, but it was another set of injuries. It made me more curious if there are ways in detecting in how a person behaves, writes, or even paints or draws that can help doctors have some sign that they should do further testing. Mm. That's particularly of interest because with the more common type of epilepsy being temporal lobe epilepsy, it's very often not picked up on an EEG and can't be seen in an MRI.
Why is that?
Well, if you're using the traditional EEG, there are electrodes that are on top of the brain. The part of the brain which is emanating the most misfiring of electrical impulses is down toward the bottom. So the area that it's probing, it can be comparable to listening to a conversation in the next room on the other side of the room.
Mm.
So very often, neurologists don't pick up on that.
Which makes for a very confusing experience for their patients, I imagine, if they don't know what's going on. Your particular focus has been more on those who are inclined to focal epilepsy. Just describe for us the distinction between focal and general epilepsy.
Generalized epilepsy is essentially where the...
Generalized, beg your pardon, yeah.
Yeah, where the whole brain shuts down or it malfunctions at once. Focal epilepsy is usually where there is a scar or limited area of the brain that's damaged that can lead to misfiring of electrical impulses that spread throughout the brain and synthesize the different thought processes. And it can be transient in just a matter of seconds. When that happens, that's where you can produce the very complex intrinsic perceptions where you have a culmination of many, many facets of thought that are blended together instantaneously.
Mm. So in terms of the works in this exhibition and the works of artists that you've spoken to, are there works that have particularly stand out for you, perhaps that we can talk about?
Some of the work that was most fascinating to me was the art of a participant who doesn't mind me saying his name. He is Howard Smith out of Geelong. It's really of interest to me because he allowed us, through another study, to actually take images of his brain functioning. That occurred while he was drawing, so I could see some of the parallels between how the brain functioned and how it could influence art.
And what did you see?
Well, what we saw was an intensification of color, an altered shape in how he perceived things, and his drawings became more surreal and dreamlike. We started with an instruction to draw something that he perceived during his seizures or leading up to his seizures. It's the time really leading up to seizures and in between seizures that we saw were the greatest changes in art, because when a person's having a seizure, they're not functioning to a point they can draw.
No.
So he was having, while he was alert and conscious, what are called intraectal discharges, where it's just 2 seconds or less, the brain will misfire. And that happened in a large part of his left hemisphere. So in the first drawing, he showed what was perceived. The second drawing, I asked him to draw a picture of someone's face that he recognized, and that became distorted and surreal. And in the third drawing, we ask him to draw simple geometric figures. And once again, those became very surreal and creature-like, but still that contained the geometric elements.
Now, this is only one artist. Are there general conclusions that you've drawn from your analysis of the work of, well, over 100 artists?
The conclusions are, in comparing the drawings in a creativity test of people with epilepsy to their family members, there was a significantly high increased level of creativity. We chose family members because they're the closest in genetic background and also environmental background. We also looked at their artworks and had an art therapist interpret those. We even had the artists fill out surveys and do interviews so we could confirm that everything that I observed and she observed was valid. Mm. And when they did their confirmation, we had some very interesting findings of just how common it was for people to take the intrinsic perceptions that they had as a result of epilepsy, then to include that into their artworks. And we saw those type of intrinsic perceptions also end up in the creativity test. So we had a very clear link to epilepsy and creativity.
Which is interesting indeed. And I mean, those intrinsic perceptions, just remind us of some of those, of examples of those.
Okay, well, first of all, it can be a complex intrinsic perceptions, and that is comparable to a pseudo-hallucination. I call it pseudo because a person will actually be conscious and able to remember and later depict that imagery in art. And that can be something that's dreamlike or surreal. And it's quite complex usually, and it's distinguishable in many occasions from what someone may do in doing a surreal artwork, being it copied off of something else or pieced together from images. It's very integrated, as if a person was living the experience.
Mm, some of these books are quite trippy and otherworldly, aren't they? And I guess there can be a stigmatizing assumption here sometimes too, that if you have epilepsy, you must somehow be an artist, you must be more creative, and people with mental illness celebrate this but also are stigmatised by this assumption. It can risk romanticising what can be quite a disabling experience.
It does have the tendency, if you have, say, what's called a numinous aura, which is an impulse of a religious or spiritual enlightenment that can be quite unique, that a person may perceive oneself as a shaman or as having an epiphany or being where they saw something very frightful. And with the symptoms of epilepsy, sometimes it can trigger an intense fear without any external cause. And that is one of the things that can make artworks look uncomfortable for others to view.
Mm. How might all this, do you think, be better used to better understand epilepsy? Do you feel that there's an extension to this work beyond the exhibition and your PhD?
I'm currently extending it and working with Melbourne Medical School. We're doing a workshop and a pilot study associated with the art exhibition. So one of the things we're doing is to help medical students interpret art and be able to see some of the signature traits of epilepsy in the works that they view. We're also using the artworks to help them better understand the patient so they increase their empathy toward the individual, not just because of the neurological condition, but also because of the emotional aspects and the psychosocial impacts of a person.
Absolutely crucial work. How interesting to talk to you, Jim Chambliss. Thank you and congratulations on the exhibition. Good luck with it this weekend.
Thank you very much.
Jim Chambliss, the exhibition is Epilepsy, Perception, Imagination and Change, on at the University of Melbourne's Cultural Treasures Festival. Lots of stuff happening this weekend and it's free. We'll link to it on our website. And I would really love to hear from you. If you have epilepsy, what do you think of Jim's observations with his work? Get on our Facebook page. I'll pop a post up there a little later in the morning and we'd love to hear from you. Or you can get on our website. Perhaps you have a story to tell as an artist with epilepsy. And speaking of art, Michael Williams is hosting Books and Arts Daily this morning. Good morning.
Morning, Natasha. How are you doing?
I'm very well. What's on your agenda?
I don't know if you remember the terrible Tom Hanks, Meg Ryan movie from 1998, You've Got Mail, but in that the villain of the piece was a big chain bookstore. I think if it was made again today, it would probably be Amazon in that role. And so we're just unpicking that a bit. There's a big stoush going on between Amazon and US publisher Hachette, and we think rather than thinking about goodies and baddies, we're going to see whether there's more to it than that.
Oh, it's such an important debate, that one. Changing the face of publishing across the world. Michael Williams coming up with Books and Arts Daily, and I'll be with you tomorrow. Looking forward to your company, 10 a.m.